Shrink Wrap Radio number 561, Narcissism and Love, with Jungian analyst Kenneth Kemmel.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is Kenneth A. Kemmel, Jungian analyst, author, teacher, and consultant with 30 years of clinical practice. We'll be discussing his 2011 book, Eros and the Shattering Gaze, Transcending Narcissism. For more information about Kenneth A. Kemmel, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Ken Kemmel, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you here all the way from Seattle.
Right.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, it's great to have you on the show. One of my listeners, Lisa Flatiger, I believe is her name, she wrote me multiple times suggesting you as a guest to talk about narcissism. So that's how we got here. And before we get into that, what can you tell us about your own personal journey that led you to become a Jungian analyst?
Oh boy, that's a really long story.
Well, give us the highlights of it.
So to begin with, I have always felt like Jung has been stalking me. When I was about 8 years old, I joined a synagogue on Pico Boulevard in West LA.
I know that. I know that area. I grew up in LA.
And across the street from the synagogue was this place which I thought was a Chinese dentist at 8 years old. And it was called the Jung Institute.
Yeah, wow.
And it was only much later that I realized that it was, in fact, this area of study that I was so deeply drawn to, you know, since late high school, early college, where a friend of mine, Tom Stone, he and I went to San Francisco State together, and his uncle was Hal Stone, who was the past president of the Jung Institute, and he's the one who developed voice dialogue for the old timers among your listeners that remember voice dialogue. Uh-huh. And we used to go over to Uncle Hal's house and just chat, you know, in high school and first years of college. And so it just felt like Jung was close by throughout my early life.
Yeah, really. And the name Max Zeller comes to mind. Was he the founder of that institute?
He was, his wife for years and years and years was the, ran the bookstore at the Jung Institute. And I would go in there often, and, the book, the Puer Aeternus, literally jumped off the bookshelf, when I went in there, by Marie-Louise von Franz, which is of course the, I think the earliest narcissistic relation to the self through the Puer Aeternus. And so that was a very disturbing book for me, and the most enlightening book I'd read in my early 20s. So my friend Tom also, when we got to San Francisco State, he gave me a book to read. It was called Damien, and was by Hermann Hesse.
Right.
And he kind of initiated me in many respects to the world of Jung. And Damien, of course, is was written in a fortnight by Hesse, who was in up in the Swiss Alps in a sanatorium, kind of a retreat, really. And he was in intensive Jungian analysis over a couple months with this analyst there. And it was during that time that he wrote Damien.
I didn't know that background on Hesse. That's very interesting.
So that's my early life. I call that my former life with classical Jungian analysis. And now currently I'm more contemporary, and I see Jung as an important light in in the world of psychoanalysis, philosophy. I mean, he was so steeped in so many different areas, right. Anthropology, archaeology, so forth. But I see him as one of many important luminaries in the field of psychoanalysis and philosophy and theology.
Yeah,
which
you
I'm
mentioned
interested
in a conversation that we had before this that you let me know that you're drawn to other psychodynamic and philosophical approaches as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Lacan, and I've not read Lacan at all.
Yeah.
But so
I know enough Lacan to be dangerous.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, the tagline for this show is enough psychology to make you just a little bit dangerous. So.
Well, you know, I really begin my book with an idea that Lacan developed, which basically alienated him from particularly the American Psychoanalytic Association, because he blew holes through the whole notion of ego psychology, that we're born with this undeveloped ego and it's our path in life to try to develop our ego, to strengthen our capacity to adapt to life, so forth and so on. Whereas Lacan saw the ego similar to Winnicott in some ways, the object relations British psychoanalyst, as a false self, in a sense. So when the baby's 6 months old and we're basically discombobulated, we're fragmented, we have no sense of self, there's no psychic structures that we have in time. And then mother comes to us and shows us our reflection in the mirror, and mother says, "That's you, baby, that's you." And from that moment on, there's kind of a split between our disorganized, disjointed sense of our own inner being with that image of this perfected whole view of who we appear to be. And we get this affirmation and this recognition from the mother and from the world that that's who we are. And we go through life and we develop this false self that split off from our core, which is fragmented and uncertainty and psychotic. We don't have any, when we're a baby, we don't have any motor skills, none of that. But as we grow up, we continue to extend that into life, whereas we develop personas. We have to be the psychologist. We have to be the judge. We have to be the lawyer. We have to be the whatever it is, so that people see us. We're invested with this symbolic power by the sovereign authority out there in the world that sort of validates who we are. And we have to fight to the death to maintain that notion of perfection to the world. And that's so pervasive in our society and culture. It's sort of the way of things. So part of the notion behind the shattering gaze, which is part of the title of the book.
Yeah. Just for our viewers, I'm holding up the book right now.
This notion of the shattering, it's the shattering of this illusion that can create distortions in perception in relationships, where we have to maintain control over the world, over relationships. Because of that basic fragmented self, we're terrified of venturing into. On the one hand, you know, we're living at a time in culture where we're predisposed towards life at the surface of things, caring about eternal beauty and the perfect relationship, and if that one doesn't work out, then easily disposable, we go on to the next one, and so forth and so on. And so I think that that's that part of the shattering speaks to often something traumatic that occurs in a narcissistic man's life or a woman, but I focus more on the male perspective, that basically deconstructs our view of ourselves, our need for that false self to control our lives and our relationships.
Yeah, I like the way that you presented that part where you touch on Lacan's theory of the very beginning of our self-awareness. And I struggled with that quote a little bit. I kind of I wasn't sure that I could grab onto that, but I think the context that you've given it right now, it's good for now. Now, you wrote this book in 2011. It's a very scholarly book that looks to me like it would have taken a long time to write. How many years did you work on this book?
Let's see, I'm 67 now, probably. I've been working on it for probably about 63 years, I'd say.
Okay.
But the actual thinking of it, you know, and unconsciously living it in some ways. But in terms of serious writing, 10 years, but I'd say a total of about 15 in formulating a lot of the ideas. But by about 2010, it was pretty much together. So we're talking about 8 years ago.
Yeah. So it's almost kind of, it's an important part of your life's work. It sounds like it took a chunk out of your life, and that it got started way back when you discovered that book on the Puer Eternus,
correct?
Right? In your teens.
Yes.
Wow. That's amazing and rare. Mm-hmm. And the book addresses two levels of narcissism, really, which you just kind of alluded to. One level is a certain sort of male journey, and the other level is about our culture here in the United States, which you characterize as narcissistic. So let's start with that part a little bit more. You made some reference to it. What leads you to characterize the U.S. as narcissistic, as living on the surface, et cetera? And is it just the U.S. or is it the West?
I think it's the Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, boy, that is such a broad question. And there's historical precedents for our culture. You go back to Plato and Plato's notion of the ideal is saying that the good and the beautiful go together. So there's this sense of this idealistic foundational truth that beauty and the good are privileged over the ugliness of nature and the senses and the human condition, because the human condition changes and goes through deaths and rebirths, whereas the ideal image of beauty, those forms are eternal, and I think that can be a looked at as a dangerous precedent, because it devalues the human, the common, the things that change, the things that are imperfect. And so narcissism tends to maintain a sense of above time that transcendent of the human condition, this kind of perfection. And so that carries forward. I can go through various points of time, but the turn of the century, from the 1800s to the 1900s, a great book by the Picture of Dorian Gray.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned that book
that.
In your book, yeah,
right. And so it's a classic example of the narcissistic character in this in our society, where there's this sense of maintaining eternal life and eternal beauty at the cost of the capacity to love. So Dorian Gray, it's sort of a gothic horror story on the one hand, because the longer Dorian Gray stays young and youthful and beautiful, the more his reflection in this painting that was done by this artist starts to grow older and meaner, and grotesque. He falls in love with this beautiful actress who plays all the great roles in life, and he's in love with love, so to speak. And he, they have a love affair, and she naturally assumes back then in Victorian age that they're going to marry, and she'll of course stop her work as an actress, and she'll have his babies, and he starts to pull away in this cold withdrawal, like she's no longer the ideal object.
Yeah.
Any longer. And she's come down to earth, and he breaks it off with her in this cold way. And then he finds out the next day that she's committed suicide. And he talks about how he feels this strange feeling, like he's somehow in this romantic play, but he's somewhat removed from it. And he should be feeling remorse. He should be feeling terrible, but he kind of feels nothing. I mean, that in a nutshell is an aspect of what the object relations folks describe as a destructive narcissism. It's the destruction of links when people start to get too close, when mm-hmm. things cease to be that idyllic, wondrous oneness that we yeah. all seek in romantic love, yeah. which is really the narcissism is underneath the process of romantic love.
And so we have plenty of contemporary examples like selfies. What could be more obviously narcissistic than right. this obsession with selfies, or the reality TV shows that we see yeah. and how people long to be famous yeah. for being famous, like the Kardashians and so on. And many
times you're forgetting our president.
I was just going there. I'm not forgetting our president, because as you were saying, precedents, there were precedents, and I was hearing that as, yes, and there's a president too. Yeah. So they say that we get the politicians we deserve, and our yeah. current president is widely characterized as narcissistic. People who didn't even know the word narcissism now yeah. probably know it, because he's so frequently yes. characterized that way. Do you see yeah. his ascension to that office as somehow symptomatic of our national narcissistic psyche?
Well, I would go deeper than that. I think he has strong sociopathic qualities. So the extremes of destructive narcissism turn into sociopathic ones. Like in the Dorian Gray story, he has to destroy links. You know, there's this sense of, that he can't really feel empathy. That's an aspect of the sociopathic quality. I mean, in all fairness, if we look at the other side of the political fence, Bill Clinton, with his affairs, could be considered more defensively narcissistic, which is different than the destructive narcissism. Defensive narcissism is the looking for the one to feel complete. Let's back up a little bit. I know I'm getting off the track of the cultural icon, but I'll circle back to yeah. To the cultural. So my contention, it's that of Neville Symington, who's an Australian British object relations psychoanalyst. He wrote a book on narcissism, which was a series of lectures that he gave that were taped. They're seminars, really, that he taped with a small group. Very profound book, and he talked about the notion of defensive narcissism as an early wounding in life, where the infant, either through maternal deprivation or some sort of traumatic experience or some sort of experience of abandonment, some profound trauma, where the infant turns in and develops a, Kalshed would call it a self-care system, whereby the, in order to protect against the possibility of another wounding later in life that reminds them of the initial wounding with the mother or what have you, or that maternal container. And so it creates a, the self-care system creates a kind of encapsulation of the ego, so that whenever things start to get too close, then there's the terror of the inner life, or and there's a terror of the outer life, of relationships becoming dangerous. And so going circling back to relationships, often from what I heard, the scuttlebutt in Washington, D.C. at the time of Clinton's presidency is whenever Hillary and Clinton had an argument and Hillary would storm off, he'd feel fragmented. And he'd look to be restored through sexual liaisons. Mm-hmm. And this wouldn't have been necessarily only in the Oval Office or in the White House rather, but in the, when he was governor, when he was younger, that right. he looked to restore himself, through sexual fusion. And then of course, once it's lived out, then they're debased, then they're devalued objects. The one he looks to restore himself. And you can look at that in a very broad way, where in many men will seek that type of, again, this notion of oneness, of this attempt to be restored. I talk about the split feminine, which is the notion of the man wants the safe, nurturing, stable, mothering type wife, and he gets bored, and so he looks to be enlivened by the ingenue, by the femme inspiratrice, the inspirational woman, or the seductress, and he sort of swings between these two. When he gets too far out on the limb with this one who brings an uncertainty and threat to his stability, he swings back again to be restored by that mothering woman again, and he's always floating above life, never quite committed to either one, and he's destructive to both ultimately.
Let me ask you about Jung himself, since we know that he had at least one long-term extramarital relationship, and is he somehow part of that same dynamic and process that you're talking about? Somehow he mostly gets a pass from Jungians, you know, that he was special. And so what's your take on that in the context of your book and all your work and thinking about this?
Well, in the same chapter about Clinton, I talk about Jung, and I primarily focus on his first experience. While I don't any longer believe that it was a sexual relationship, but it was a deeply romantic relationship with Sabina Spielrein, who yes. was his first psychoanalytic case. He was working, he was trying the new method, the talking cure, with her, and she was a patient originally, and later she assisted in the association experiments. She went to medical school, and she tried to repair things between Freud and Jung unsuccessfully. And then she actually went and studied with Freud in Vienna and became really the first child psychoanalyst mm-hmm. and went to Russia and taught and worked with children, traumatized children, and then was murdered by the Nazis when they invaded Russia.
Yeah, yeah.
But absolutely, that dynamic between Freud and Spielrein and Emma, who was busy having babies, while, you know, he had this profound transference, countertransference relationship. And back then, they didn't know what countertransference and transference was about. They really hadn't defined it. They basically defined it through this relationship where she basically was cured of her problems. And there's a lot of debate now as to, you know, what her diagnosis truly was. But basically they had a romantic love affair, probably kissing, holding. She talked about it as poetry, but most people assumed that it was a sexualized one, but they were in Victorian era, and there's pretty good research now by Dr. Lothanne, who went and spoke to the living descendant of Spielrein and had Jung was head over heels for her. She left him, and he was, you know, despairing. And so I think that desire for oneness, they were very romantic. They loved Wagner and all of his operas, and they fantasized the birth of their own psychological son, Siegfried, who's of course the character in a very important in Wagner's ring cycle, and as the Norse god, and very important to Jung in his dreams about Siegfried and the death of Siegfried in the Red Book and so forth and so on. But anyway, so yeah, very much so this this split feminine dynamic going on between the two of them.
And I can really buy the idea of that intense romanticized relationship that was not sexual or not acted out sexually. I go back to my own adolescence where I was in a kind of religious environment and where there was this really passionate feeling for the girlfriend, you know, and it wasn't sexual.
Right.
But geez, just holding hands would transport you to to another realm. So, you know, I can identify a lot with this kind of man that you're describing in the book, this eternal child man. Are we talking about a specific kind of male journey? I guess in extremes we are. Is there a more generalized way in which it's kind of true of most men or not?
Well, I think there's the understanding that the first love of our lives is mother, for all intents and purposes. And so we grow up idealizing that relationship to some extent, unless it's so horrific that we look to some other object to project that ideal onto. But certainly in adolescence, it's normal to have that idealization. But then, you know, I've had patients that have told me about that once the ideal is broken, like they've kissed or she's done something that's broken the spell, then in the narcissistic male, it's not a journey as much as kind of a repetition compulsion, where that girl or woman becomes devalued, becomes imperfect, no longer the ideal, the idyllic one. And so you go on to the next one, and then the next one, and the next one. And then you learn to just be sexual, just the lust, and to have those types of women. You keep them there in that place, and then you can idealize the wife or the mother, what have you. But there's no kind of integrating process of finding the both in one person. It's like learning to accept the limitations. Again, I'm going to run back to Lacan for a moment here, and he has a lovely concept. And other people have talked about it in different ways, and Jung talked about it in different ways still. But he talks about Das Ding, which is means the thing. And it, he describes it as some kind of fragment of a some sort of remainder in the primal unconscious that can never be known, that we're always longing for, we're always longing to realize, whether it's in love or it's in art or it's in religion or what have you, but it always remains behind it. And in some ways you can think of it as this maternal container, this idealized fantasy that we have no way of knowing, but it's a fantasy because we're too young to conceptualize it, that we keep longing to realize, but it's never quite, we could never quite find it. That lack, that basic lack is always with us, that we're always longing to find and never fulfill. And on a basic level, it's what perhaps drives artists to create, or those of us who have a mystical bent to seek and to search for that mystical oneness that can never quite be found, where, you know, it's there, we touch it, and then it flitters away. You know, we only get a glimpse. We can only see a glimpse. And in a sense that if we can accept that limitation as human beings, that we'll never know. There's always a level of uncertainty in life. We can accept limitations. The profound humanness, brokenness in our human being, we can learn to accept the limitations in the human other, along with the moments, the glimpses of brilliance and beauty. So it really, the relationships are not about oneness. Those are just fragmentary moments in time. Mm-hmm. It's really about accepting our sense of two-ness. Because otherwise, a person with a narcissistic predisposition, the moment that one starts to feel that oneness, they start to feel dependency. They start to feel vulnerability. And a vulnerability has translated in the past to being hurt or harmed or fragmented in some kind of way, or controlled or entrapped. The terror of those things, then they're going to destroy that relationship and move away, either through some kind of narcissistic wounding of the other person or withdrawal, deadness, turning away. But if one can accept through the process of kind of developing one's own sense of themselves, of their own limitations, their own capacity to tolerate vulnerability and dependency as an aspect of intimacy, and that recognizes that other isn't looking to entrap you, vice versa. You're not looking to try to control the other, but they're whole unto themselves, and I'm whole unto myself, and I'm not needing them to fill me or to control me. Then intimacy can come through dependency, and vulnerabilities are natural things because it's about two-ness, not about oneness.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I'm really getting off on what you're saying. I was interested in that sort of, that there was, when you were talking about the thing, that there was this sort of a positive aspect of this dynamic, that it can either go off the rails as a fixation, as a repetitive fixation, as you pointed out, but that there's also a variant of it that's a kind of a channeling in a direction of reaching for the transcendent isn't always bad.
Knowing that you'll never truly, wholly, fully grasp it. There's an uncertainty factor. There's always gaps in our knowing.
And in
it kind of keeps us humble.
In the book, you talk about psychotherapy as an important tool or path for getting out of that loop, that destructive loop. But you remark, among others, you said, among others. And I wondered, well, what are the others the other ways that people, that men who are trapped in some kind of a mother complex that gets them into this pattern, what are some of the other ways that they get out?
Well,
maybe you don't see those people because they don't come to you.
Well, no, I certainly have a sense of it. I mean, some people are really deeply involved in recovery work. You know, the 12-step stuff, whatever, mm-hmm. whichever way it shows up, through sexual addiction or through alcohol or drug addiction, they find that way. That can be a way of working through some of this behavior. Often it helps people to learn how to behave, as opposed to changing people at the core of things. But sometimes that's okay. Not everybody is cut out for psychoanalysis or psychoanalytic psychotherapies, you know, deeper work. Some people find faith-based approaches that, again, gives people a community and through moral development, if you will, they develop a sense of discipline, a capacity for truth-telling in their own communities, confessionals. I mean, that can help some people that aren't interested in kind of going the more lonely individual route of a depth psychology of some kind, ongoing hard work.
Yeah.
Nothing short term, but things ongoing. You know, people I know that have studied for 20, 25 years Buddhism and those practices, you know, you find that type of mature psyche rather than the more immature psyche that keeps looking to that romantic, narcissistic fantasy that someone else is going to restore them.
People mature.
It's about maturation, I think.
Yeah, interesting that you say maturation, because I certainly, as I was reading the book, I was identifying with, you know, to a large extent. It was tough going at times, saying, geez, it seems like he's kind of describing me to some extent here. And I feel like I have aged out of that.
Yes. So, Jung used to say that. Jung used to say, we don't overcome complexes, we outgrow them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. And I'm thinking back to when I was a young man and I went to Spain, and prostitution was an accepted institution there. And I did not, just for the record, I did not go to any prostitutes. I was a young man, and I met a waiter in a bar, and he talked me into coming and living with his family instead of paying money at the hotel. That was great. And I hung out with him in his bar, and a lot of prostitutes hung out there as well. And it was fun joking around with him and so on. But it seemed like at that time, in that culture, prostitution was kind of accepted, that men would go off on a bender periodically. Mm-hmm. Where does that kind, and that's true, you know, to some degree in our own culture and other countries, where does that fit in? And it also raises, and I know this is big questions, issues that I'm raising here, we also should maybe talk about the psychology of the woman, because those men who are being the eternal boy, there's some eternal girl or something.
The puella.
that they're finding.
Yeah. Well, they'll more oftentimes than not find the mother, because the puer you're speaking of, the eternal boy, is often looking for the mother who's going to contain him and control him, and that's going to set in motion issues of rebellion and all that. So we're talking about youth. I mean, Spain is a very religious country, and so there's that sense of the compensatory at work. You don't marry out of wedlock. You don't have sex out of wedlock, that sort of stuff. And so the compensation for prostitution is understandable. And a young man, if that's an acceptable avenue in society, then it's the norm. Then it's sort of regulated in a sense. And but the problem arises when prostitution is in lieu of one's capacity to tolerate rejections when you're actually pursuing a real human relationship with all of its difficulties and problems. How does one tolerate the terrors of too much closeness or abandonment or being dropped without resorting to swinging to the other side and trying to restore oneself through some sort of sexual fusion for a moment, and then in turn, after the sexual act is over with, the loss of all feeling, and you kind of drop that prostitute because it's a business arrangement, and you can go on, you feel restored again. If that's a repetitious process, then you're falling into that kind of defensive, destructive, narcissistic patterning, and it goes on into one's 20s and one's 30s and one's 40s. That's when it becomes pathological. But I mean, young men sowing their wild oats in various ways, or women for that matter, sowing their wild oats, that's something that young people do. The hormones are a lot different than they are for you and I now.
Yes, I'll say. You know, in your book is loaded with references to mythology and to contemporary films, which I really like because I'm a big movie goer, and also to case history. So feel free to sprinkle any of those in as we go along here. You've already mentioned the picture of Dorian Gray. And
Yes. Well, one that comes to mind is one of the Arthurian romances of Lancelot and Guinevere. And of course, Lancelot and Guinevere are the classic star-crossed lovers. She's married to the good King Arthur, and yet she represents from those tales, those fables at the time, sort of a reenactment of a lot of the Greek mysteries, where she's really, as the queen, she's the nature's life force. And Lancelot, as the knight, as the first knight, is sworn to serve her and the king, and he'll die for her. And so in a sense, he's in service to the great mother, in from a mythological standpoint. Mm-hmm. So, and they're both terribly in love as well. So in one of these stories, it's called The Knight and the Cart. She's captured by this bad knight, this evil knight, who turns out to be the Lord of Death. So he takes her to the land, his realm of death, and Lancelot goes in search for her. He goes through all kinds of trials, temptations, like initiation steps in a sense, where he has to find her at all costs. And the last test is he's told that he has to climb aboard this pillory cart. The pillory carts were meant to parade people around who were guilty of crime. So it would be, he'd have to climb off of his charger and climb onto the pillory cart. And he hesitates for just one moment before climbing aboard. It's like it's his pride, or he doesn't want to be associated with that kind of lesser man. But he climbs aboard, and then he finds her, he overcomes death, and he brings her back. And instead of being happy to see him, she turns away from him. She rejects him, and he goes insane, and he tries to kill himself. And he's just mad. He's gone mad. And several of these stories show when she rejects him, he goes mad. There's one other story who goes into the woods and lives as a wild man when he grows his hair long and for years. And finally, he comes out and she forgives him. So finally, she relents in this story, and she explains why she turned away from him. And it was because of that one moment of hesitation that his love for her wasn't certain, that he wasn't thinking of her above all else, and that's why she turned away from him. So there's that sense of madness, of the inability, because of this fusion, this desperate need to complete that sense of that finding that missing piece, that das Ding that their fusion represents, that drove him mad because he couldn't tolerate sense of being a separate self, a separate being. And I find that a very important metaphor for these types of romantic fusions, which Jung and Edinger described as the death conjunctio. The conjunctio is that Latin word for the sacred union. Mm-hmm. It's a death conjunctio that ultimately leads into this, where one or both, it's like a sadomasochistic kind of relationship where it doesn't end well. It never ends well for these kinds of relationships, especially when they're younger. So that's one example that comes to mind. One more promising story is, which is probably one of my most favorite movies, it's The Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yeah.
The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind with Kate Winslet and Jim Carrey.
I have to see it again because I saw it. I saw that you made reference to it, but I don't really, I need to see it again because clearly I didn't take away as much as there was there. So yeah, give us your version.
Right. Well, again, the longer version is in the book. But basically these two come together and then like many postmodern relationships, they, she's vibrant and crazy. She changes her hair color every month. He's introverted and studious, intellectual, and they're kind of opposites attract, and she's wild and crazy and takes risk, and he's very cautious, and yet they make it work. And they're together over a few years, and then finally they decide to break up just because of they cease to he starts to regress into kind of a critical, judgmental side, and she eggs him on. Anyway, and the film goes back and forth in time, so you never quite know. You have to see it several times before you understand the time changes in it. Mm. The temporality switches back and forth. So I'm giving you a linear version. So they split up, and she goes to this place called Lacuna. And Lacuna is a Greek word, but it has to do with those blank compartments in the mind where there's no knowing, there's no remembering. It's just an empty space. It's more than repression. It's literally things are erased. So it's this medical facility that's able to erase memories of bad relationships. And so they spend the night, you know, using these tests on the brain and their computers and all this fantastical stuff, which thank God hasn't been created yet. It's to erase people's memory of a relationship that's gone bad so that they don't have to feel the pain of it. And that's a hallmark of narcissism, is the desire to destroy links to the other so that you don't have to feel the pain of the ongoing vicissitudes of human relationship in life. And she completely blacks him out of her mind, forgets him. And then he, when he finds out what she's done, he tries to do the same thing. But then when the awareness of the previous lives, because somehow they come back together again through some sort of hypnotic suggestion in the eraser process, they find each other again on Valentine's Day. And they see each other for the first time as strangers. And yet they begin to like each other. And then the awareness of their previous life comes to light. And they say, well, and they're listening to tape recordings of why they broke up with each other in the first place. And you could see that they just die inside when they see, oh my God, I'm attracted to this person. But God, this is what we were like. And so they're going to break up. And then he stops her in the hallway. And she says, why are you doing this? You know, we're only going to hate each other again. I'm going to be critical of you and you're going to be judgmental of me. And we're never going to, you know, we're going to never accept each other. And he says, okay, okay. It's sort of this recognition. Our flaws are always with us. You know, our imperfections are always with us, and we will project our own hatred of our own inferiorities onto the other person if we're feeling insecure and insufficient in ourselves. And if we can kind of get that in that profound step of maturation, we can recognize the other is just a human being. And yet, despite that, can we accept their imperfections in our own? Then there's a possibility of finding a deeper kind of love, a love that's not based on this projection process of being the perfect one or the best sex or what have you, which, you know, goes away over time. So it's just, for me, it's probably one of the most profound stories. And the title, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, is based on a story. It's actually a historical story from two lovers from medieval times, Evelyn and Abelard. He was a scholar, but of lowly origin, and Evelyn was his pupil who came from a very lofty family. And they fell in love, and they wanted to be together. And her family found out about it and castrated him. And he went off to a monastery, and he told her to do the same. Their love could never be. And so she goes away, and she becomes a nun. And the two of them live separately. Then many, many years later, they correspond in writing. And she's written these poems, which have to do with, take this pain away from me. May my mind be... have eternal sunshine of the spotless mind. It's this desire to not have to feel the pain of the human relationship, where the two of them can kind of be together in this spiritualized place above the human dimension. And that's where the name of the film comes from. And so it's quite profound.
Yeah. Wow, you're such a good storyteller. take us through one more film that everybody will have seen, which is The Graduate.
You're dating your audience.
I'm saying everybody will have seen. I realize as I say that that's exactly what I'm doing.
Oh my goodness! Well,
a lot of people will have seen it.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, he's another cultural iconic story about this guy who's depressed because he's been invested by the sovereign authority that he's a graduate now, and the society, the culture is going to say he's going to go on and do great things in this world, and he ought to go into plastics. That's where the real money is, right?
Yeah, remember? Right, right.
And he's terribly depressed because, like this, the child of the 60s, he's lost and doesn't know what to really do. So there's these famous scenes of being down at the bottom of the swimming pool in his scuba mask, looking up. Mm-hmm. And that's a perfect example of sort of this narcissistic, depressive encapsulation where he just wants to be cut off from life. And then until he's awakened by this older woman who's the wife of his father's business partner, Mrs. Robinson, right? Anne Bancroft, and Dustin Hoffman is, of course, the graduate. And, Song of Silence is broken by this lusty sexual relationship that brings him into life again, albeit it's a sexual physical life, but it's embodied. And in a sense, Mrs. Robinson is the most real character in the film. I mean, she's married to this guy she doesn't love. She's an alcoholic. She basically bides her time through affairs that she keeps discreet and all that. But anyway, he's talked into, the families want to get the Robinson's daughter, Catherine Ross, Elaine is her name in the film. They want to fix up the two kids. And Mrs. Robinson, of course, is furious, and she doesn't want him, he's not good enough for her daughter, who she's trying to protect for something else, some someone better than him. And anyway, they of course they fall in love, Elaine and Ben, and then they're torn apart, and then he fights for, you know, to redeem. He steals her away in this very romantic fashion from this wedding that she's at, and the film ends where the two of them are sitting in her wedding dress and at the back of the bus, and they're sort of looking at each other kind of like, well, what do we do now? So
rebelled, what's next?
Yes, right. And so I sort of fantasize about a kind of a more postmodern ending to this story, where what happens if the two in 3 months, she kind of comes to her senses and goes back to her pristinely manicured, safe life, because she doesn't show that she has much of her own. She's sort of a two-dimensional figure, Elaine in mm-hmm. the film. But what if she just goes back to that safe world, this unliberated feminine woman? What does he do then? And my fantasy is maybe the loss of that ideal will drive him to such a narcissistic despair of not being able to tolerate the loss of Dasting, this ideal romantic other, that he goes down to the bottom of the pool, this time lifeless and dead, that he can't tolerate that and he suicides. So that's my own fantasy.
That's actually a whole bunch of other movies that more or less have that kind of a scenario. Maybe even temporally, culturally, a whole batch of movies, that kind of movie came into being.
Yes.
Now, I'm wondering about your analytic practice, given you spent so much time on this eternal child.
Yes, I've been typecast.
I'm wondering
in line with films. Yeah, I work with a lot of men now.
That's what I was wondering.
I work with a lot of women who have gone through very painful, horrific relationships, sometimes multiple relationships with men who are destructively narcissistic, and they need some way of understanding the loss, sometimes ex-wives, sometimes girlfriends, sometimes in homosexual relationships, men who are with a man that's kind of acting out in a similar kind of way. So it's not gender specific, certainly.
Yeah. Well, you've been generous with your time. Speaking of your practice, I know that you've got a client hour coming up in just a few minutes. Is there anything that you'd like to say to kind of close this off that maybe you were thinking that you would have a chance to say, but you didn't get to?
Not really. It feels like a very lively conversation. You're really a good interviewer, and you give the interviewee lots of space to kind of riff and go off and whatever. Yeah. But you led me into areas that I have a lot of feeling and passion about, and so you gave me an opportunity to say, I think, a lot of important things that it'd be important for men to know and to have a better understanding of, and particularly for their relationships, the spouses, the people in their lives that, or exes that have been deeply impacted by them. So,
thank you. Well, that's a wonderful place for us to close.
Very good.
So, Kenneth Kimmel, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're very welcome.
I'm so glad that listener Lisa Flatiger recommended Kenneth Kimmel. His book is quite a Jungian tour de force on the topic of narcissism. We barely scratched the surface. In particular, There are numerous case vignettes, which will be of interest to all therapists out there. And I'm sure the Jungian enthusiasts in my audience will particularly appreciate his retelling of a number of myths, such as psyche and amor, eros and psyche, among others. You heard his retelling of the films The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and The Graduate, as well as the story of The Picture of Dorian Gray. He references a number of other films, including Bram Stoker's Dracula, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, High Fidelity, and The Natural. Among some of the topics we didn't get to were his discussion of the split masculine, the role of trauma, and the role of the father, both personal and archetypal, in the development of the narcissistic personality. I love the way that he really came to life when he shared these stories with us. After the interview, I let him know that I was surprised to experience him as so lively. His intellect certainly came across in the book, but not the quality of being with him that we got in the interview. I very much agree with his perspective on the narcissism that characterizes this particular time in Western culture. He shared with me that this book is his, quotes, magnum opus, having taken years to write and research. And I agree, it's a, quotes, big book in the sense of importance for us and our time. The book is a bit under 300 pages, including a glossary, references, and chapter notes. There is much to mine here. The title of the book, once again, is Eros and the Shattering Gaze, Transcending Narcissism. As always, if you decide to buy it, I urge you to use our Amazon.com widget, which you will find in the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. You have a fantastic podcast with fantastic interviews and a really wide range of fantastic guests. Thank you for what you do. But this message is about the not-so-fantastic reasons that some of your listeners don't financially support Shrink Wrap Radio. My silly reason? I've had a PayPal account for years and years, but it's associated with the email address for my small business. I kept meaning to talk to my bookkeeper about how an ongoing donation would and wouldn't work gracefully, but I never remembered to do it. And months went by. Every time I listened to a new episode, oh right, that! Just a few weeks ago, it dawned on me. Hello, self! You have personal email too! You could solve this by simply sidestepping your absentmindedness. Account made, problem solved, donation launched. And what a silly reason to have taken so long. So listeners, what's your silly reason? It's already there. It's free. Why should I pay for something that's free? I'm guessing this is one of the most common silly reasons. But think of it this way. Lots of people are creating great content for free these days, which is pretty fantastic when you pause to think about it. And the free content that catches on and inspires actual people to spend actual money, that content is more likely to persist and to inspire other similar content. So by donating to Shrink Wrap Radio, you are an agent for content evolution. You're saying, yes, I wish to help curate this space and encourage not only this content to continue, but also prove the viability for other similar content. Not donating because you already get it for free, that's a silly reason and also kind of self-defeating. How about, I don't have enough money to donate? Okay, I challenge you to choose a teeny amount of money. It could be a dollar, or a quarter, or 11 cents. Whatever amount you could lose in the street and really not fret about it. That's a teeny amount. Each time you listen to an episode, put that teeny amount of money in the shrink wrap jar. Once that jar accumulates a few bucks, send it off. It might not make much of a financial difference, but it will definitely make a personal difference, both for Dr. Dave and for you. Or maybe you love the show and would be happy to donate, but you don't do PayPal, have never done PayPal, and never will do PayPal. Send Dr. Dave a check. Here's a reason that's not silly. I've just started listening, and I don't yet know if the show is fantastic. Fair enough. Completely non-silly reason. So listen to another couple dozen episodes and then donate. And if, for some reason, you say, I've listened to tons of episodes, and this is an awful show. Well, in that case, I hope you have a pleasant journey back to your home planet, wherever it is, and that your time visiting Earth was enjoyable. My name is Sarinda, and I am delighted to be a continuing supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Sarinda. I tell you, folks, you must surrender to Sarinda. And by the way, she's right that you can send a check as a last resort. I get regular checks from a Mrs. Black. Since she sends me checks, I don't have her email address to send a thank you note via email. But let me say thank you right now to Mrs. Black. I hope you are listening right now. I'm sorry I'm not remembering your first name, but I do so appreciate your support, as well as all you others out there who pitch in to support Shrink Wrap Radio financially. And if you're not a financial supporter, I do hope you'll take Sarinda's message to heart and become one. And even if you don't and aren't, I'm still grateful to all you who listen. Where would I be without listeners? I'm not sure if I've previously announced this relatively new transcript on our site or not, but here it is. I'm referring to episode number 550, Archetypal Roots in the Evolution of Consciousness and the Upheaval of Paradigm Shift with Jungian analyst Jerome S. Bernstein. And that's thanks to James Stake. You know, amazingly, one-third of all the interviews on Shrink Wrap Radio have been transcribed by generous listener volunteers. If you feel the impulse at all, I encourage you to act on it by writing me and letting me know which interview you'd like to transcribe. And it's only the interview itself I'm looking for, not the other parts of the episode. These transcripts are so useful to students, to me as I'm reviewing, and to people who may not have the time to listen. And you can check to see if the episode that you're interested in transcribing has already been done or not by going to the transcript tab on shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can see what's been transcribed and what hasn't. Do you need continuing education units? We have about 100 CEs worth of APA-approved continuing education goodness that we're able to offer through the online resource of the Zur Institute. Just click on the Zur Institute link, the banner ad, partway down our left-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com, and it will take you directly to my course offerings there. Finally, let me recommend audible.com once again, which, as you've heard me say in the past, is my favorite way of listening to audiobooks, and basically how I do much of my reading, especially my recreational reading. To me, listening ends up in my brain is pretty much the same as books I've read with my eyes, and sometimes I can't recall, oh, was that one I listened to, or was that one I read? Now, I've confessed in the past that my recreational listening tends not to be podcasts or explicitly psychological, but stuff in the crime genre. As a result of a conversation with one of my buddies who's a big fan of Cormac McCarthy, whom I've never read, I decided to check out No Country for Old Men by Cormac McCarthy. Now, I did see and actually love the movie, No Country for Old Men. So I thought this would be a good one for getting into Cormac McCarthy and also would allow me to see how closely the movie followed the book. I have to tell you that when it comes to audiobooks, the reader can make or break the experience. Well, I have to tell you, the reader does a fabulous job on this one. I especially love the way he captures a certain kind of Texas accent. If you like crime novels, or if you liked that movie, I highly recommend this one to you. It's all of 7 hours and 33 minutes of pure listening joy. And if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that's not to your taste, they now have more than 250,000 titles for you to choose from. And with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks again to today's guest, Jungian analyst Kenneth Kimmel, for his insights into the many dimensions of narcissism. In the next episode, I'll be speaking with Mike Fink, co-founder and director of outreach for Thero.org. That's Thero.org, a therapist directory dedicated to making it easy to find mental health resources. As someone who has wrestled with OCD, Mike is particularly interested in reducing the stigma around mental illness and therapy seeking. So I hope you will join us then. And for now, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, babe, it's all in your mind. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.